This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 162 was recorded on April 11th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Professor Steve Keen joins me as this week's feature interview guest. Steve and I will compare notes on how we each see the debate over whether the loss of reserve currency status would benefit the United States because a weaker dollar would benefit American export businesses versus injure the United States because loss of exorbitant privilege and artificial demand for dollars would suddenly cause budget deficits to matter again. We'll also take a deep dive into Steve's views on modern monetary theory, which are eye-opening to say the very least. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when I'll be asking Patrick for a summary of the practical history of financial markets course, which he attended with Russell Napier in Toronto. Patrick has also prepared another of his famous chart books for extended market coverage later in the post-game segment.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's get right to it. This S&P 500 still up there. What's going on?
Well, the upside momentum and sentiment have been very impressive. There was hardly any resistance at 2877, which was the pre-VIX high. There was another level just below that. My chart shows R1 resistance at about 2872. The market bumped its head a couple of times on that level before breaking through it. Now we're bumping our head on round number resistance at 2900, and I don't really see any reason that we wouldn't break through that again. Now, of course, our regular listeners know that I have been saying ever since Christmas, I think that we are in a vicious bear market rally. I think that it's going to surprise us, but eventually we're not going to put in an all-time high. And I've said several times, I would be astonished if the market actually rallies to new all-time highs. Well, look, as far as those views are concerned, I'm already astonished. We've already gotten to a point where this is farther than I thought it was going to go. So I'm forced to really just revisit all of my views on equities and rethink everything. And something I like to do, especially when the market's not doing what I expected, is just to throw all of my biases and my preconceived notions and prejudices out the window and just take a completely fresh look at the charts and the situation and the fundamentals and try to figure out what's going on. And I think that probably what's going on here is, although I still think these valuations and the sentiment that we see to the upside doesn't really make any logical sense, probably, and I do have the bond market kind of on my side with respect to that, but the sentiment is still super strong. So what could that be? I think what it maybe is Jay Powell has been found out. When Powell took office, he was very outspoken and very clear saying, look, the Fed is not going to be in the business of rescuing financial markets. That's not what we're here for. It's not our job. A lot of people were skeptical about whether he really meant that, but they took him at face value, and that caused a lot of fear and trepidation. Well, it's been proven now that the Fed is going to react to weakness in markets. We've clearly seen that, and I think what may be going on is the market has returned to its previous state of complacency, thinking, hey, the Fed is there to bail us out. The Fed put is alive and well, and it's time to be long this market. Now, I do continue to think, Patrick, my view has not changed on the fundamentals. I think that we're headed into a recession by the end of 2020. I think that economic fundamentals are deteriorating. I think there's lots of reasons to be looking for this market to top out and for the bear market to continue. But my previous view that I just thought there's no way we're going to see all-time highs, surely the top has to be in. If that was going to be true, we probably would have stopped around the 61.8 retrace level. And we've seen not only has the market moved above that, but it's moved above that vigorously. So I'm already at the point of making that admission that, okay, there's more going on than I expected here. I'm astonished ahead of time that maybe we are headed toward all-time highs. I don't think it makes any sense. I still won't be surprised if that doesn't happen and it does top out here, but I'm seeing more and more signs that this market is headed higher. And I think what we should do, Patrick, is take the next step of analysis, which is really to start to look at correlations. You know, what's going on with the S&P versus what's going on with the NASDAQ versus what's going on with the Russell, and try to make sense of this. And certainly to look at what's going on with Treasury yields, because that's the one market element that seems to be agreeing with me for the moment. Needless to say, everybody's waiting to hear Steve Keen. So let's save the rest of that conversation for our postgame segment after the feature interview.
Great. So yeah, I have some charts to speak to on that. We'll touch on that in the postgame. So let's move on to that US dollar index, which has not broken out, but it's certainly holding up along those highs. What's in store here for the dollar in your mind?
Well, we're flirting with round number resistance here at 97. We've tested that level quite a few times, moved briefly above it once before. To my eye, everything still looks good for the dollar rally, in my opinion. But I do concede that, you know, what we need here technically is a clear break above 97.5 to really get bullish here. In the meantime, I still think that we do have a bull market in the dollar index, but we're kind of trading sideways to gently higher, consolidating to moving slightly up. We're not looking at breakout conditions yet. We need to see that daily close above 97 spot 50 in order to say that that is really underway. Now, we got an interesting comment from a listener about this that I want to mention because he made an excellent point. He said, Eric, you know, you're talking about resistance levels in the dollar index as if the dollar index were the controlling function here. Is it really the dollar index that people are trading, suggesting that we should care about the apparent resistance and support levels on the dollar index chart? Or would it make more sense to be looking at the underlying currency pairs which make up the dollar index? Excellent point the gentleman made. Now, if we're talking about stocks, I do think the S&P trades as an index and the underlying ends up moving in reaction to how the index trades. So it is kind of a tail wagging the dog. In the case of the dollar index, I think it really is the dollar-euro pair which has the most influence and which is governing. So it would make more sense to really understand where the dollar is headed to take a closer look at dollar-euro. So let's do that also in postgame.
Let's move on to crude oil, though, because in the last couple of weeks, we had an extraordinary advance in the tune of 10% to the upside. And it's certainly making my resolve to stay bearish be tested. What's your thinking here on crude?
Well, I said last week that it really felt to me like somebody knew something, because I was very surprised that despite a bearish inventory report, the market kept going higher as if somebody knew the news before it was happening. Of course, the very next day after our podcast, we learned that Saudi Arabia had threatened to ditch the dollar for international oil trade if the United States didn't drop this NOPEC bill, which is before Congress right now. Now, a few days later, Saudi Arabia promptly denied that they had made that threat. Frankly, it sounds to me like they did make the threat, and they received a few threats of their own from the U.S. government and decided to retract that position. Meanwhile, we've seen escalation of the Libyan situation. So, you know, we've got escalating geopolitical tensions, Saudi Arabia threatening to ditch the dollar. And this really brings up this question of if the petrodollar system were to break down. Frankly, I think it's an idle threat. I think the U.S. has already told them, don't you dare make that threat or you'll regret it. And I think they've backed down from every indication I can see that's already happened. But if it ever were to come to that, if they really did ditch the dollar and the petrodollar system broke down, it would threaten the reserve currency status of the U.S. dollar. That's something that I really regretted the last time we interviewed Steve Keen. I didn't really get into that, where Steve and I just disagree on those fundamentals. So I'm going to begin today's interview with Steve by focusing on this question of if at some point we did see a breakdown in the petrodollar system, what would that mean, and would it be a good or a bad thing for the United States? Going back to my bigger picture view on the oil market, really, my view has been that it's the combination of a persistent oversupply with deteriorating economic fundamentals. Now, the thing is, although I do seem to have a few friends in the bond market, the stock market thinks there's no problem. We're racing through what I thought should have been some pretty tough resistance. Maybe we're headed even toward new all-time highs. Nobody's thinking, other than me and the bond market, that economic conditions are deteriorating. I think that the Christmas massacre pretty much proves that there's plenty of room for a big move down in price if and when we get to that situation where the market collectively decides that the demand destruction from weakening economic conditions and persistent oversupply at the same time are a real problem. That's what led us down in December. I think it will lead us down again if the market comes back to that consensus view. That's not where we're at right now. The oversupply issue has kind of faded and everybody's focused on the escalation in Libya. At the same time, nobody's worried about economic fundamentals because the stock market is rallying. So that term structure moving into backwardation suggests that at least in the immediate time frame, the market is not really concerned about those downside risks. I still see them on the radar screen, but it's not a concern for the market right now.
Well, how are oil inventories coming in? Are they supporting this price rally?
Well, this really got my attention today. Crude oil building 7 million barrels. Massive, massive build of crude oil. You'd think, okay, that's got to be just killer bearish. There was a little spike down on the tape, and you know, within a couple of hours, everything was retraced, and we're moving back up toward the highs. So it really says something to me when a 7 million barrel build doesn't crash the market, and when the market is able to just shrug that off and move higher. Now, we have moved lower since then on Thursday, but in immediate reaction to that huge 7 million barrel build, the market just shrugged it off and moved higher. Now, there's a reason for that, which is gasoline drew down 7.7 million barrels, utterly massive drawdown in gasoline inventories, kind of makes up for the crude oil build, and at the same time, Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down, even as we had a big 7 million barrel build nationwide, Cushing, Oklahoma still drew down 1.1 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 116,000 barrels. So my view here is that the reason that we're moving out of contango at the front of the curve, the shape of the front of the curve is mostly determined by storage considerations. So it's this Cushing drawdown, and I saw the Genscape data today, which suggests we might see another draw next week. That's the reason we're moving into backwardation, even at the front of the curve. This big, big build in crude oil inventory of 7 million barrels was offset by the gasoline drawdown, and I think that's probably a big part of the reason that the market was able to shrug it off. One way or another, Patrick, the various risks that I see, and I still think they're very real, they're just not in focus right now. What the market's looking at is Libya and the situation there, the risk of what Saudi Arabia may or may not be threatening. These things are all driving prices higher. I think eventually there's plenty of room for them to move considerably lower, but not until the stock market stops convincing everybody that nothing's wrong with the economy.
All right, well, let's move on to gold. I'm dying to get your view on here. I mean, obviously, you have a bullish U.S. dollar narrative. What's your thinking here on gold?
Well, you know, we did get up briefly above 1300 for a little bit this week, but now as we're speaking Thursday afternoon, we're back below it. I really continue to hold the same view. I think that we're going to hover around here around 1300, and we need to see the dollar index break out in order to green light the next move down in gold prices. And I do think that there's plenty of room for that to happen. Now, of course, geopolitical upset, there's, you know, dovish news from the FOMC. There's lots of reasons that gold could suddenly break out. But so far, the way I'm looking at this is we're treading water here, waiting for the dollar index to break higher so that gold can begin a move lower. How much lower? I don't know. We'll have to keep an eye on it.
So, Eric, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yields, which after testing the zone below 2.4, have now started to consolidate around the 2.5 mark. What's your thinking in the next direction in yields here?
Well, I think we're at 251, 252 or so when we spoke last week. And I said, I think that may be your buying opportunity if you want to fade that rate bounce higher. If you believe, as I do, that the economic outlook really is deteriorating, maybe that's a buy-the-dip opportunity for duration risk. And so far, we've only moved a few basis points lower, but we certainly have not moved higher. So I think this was a bounce in Treasury yields. I think that the move lower could be ahead of us. I'd love to get Lacey Hunt back on the program sometime soon. Maybe you can start working on that, because I'd love to get an update from his perspective on where he's allocating on the curve. But it looks to me like, if I'm correct about economic conditions deteriorating, that we've still got lower to go in yield, and this bounce that we're seeing in yield is probably a buying opportunity.
All right, well, this week's featured interview guest is Professor Steve Keen. So, Eric, why did we invite Steve back as this week's featured interview guest?
Well, Patrick, Steve's one of my favorite guests of all time because he is a credentialed professor. He knows what he's talking about, but he is the first to acknowledge that a lot of economic finance is baloney. And he tends to deviate away from the neoclassical school of economics and really look at how things work in the real world. So I have great admiration for his views generally. And I was also particularly looking forward to getting Steve back because last time I interviewed him, he mentioned that he thinks loss of reserve currency status would be a tremendous benefit for the United States, which is very, very strongly at odds with my own view. So I'm really looking forward to asking him about that. And, you know, you'd think a guy who says the whole problem, and this has been Steve's mantra ever since 2008, he said, look, the whole problem is too much debt. That's the way we got into this economic mess in 2008, and that's the problem that we're still facing, and it hasn't been corrected yet, and that's the reason, in Steve's eyes, that another financial crisis is almost inevitable. You'd think somebody like that would be as anti-modern monetary theory as they come, but Steve is actually a fan of modern monetary theory. So are those two views incompatible? I want to try to reconcile that and get to the bottom of what seems like incompatible views that he's expressing.
Well, Eric's interview with Professor Steve Keen is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next is Professor Steve Keen, who is both the author of Debunking Economics as well as the crowdfunded Professor of Economics on Patreon. Later on in this interview, we'll come back and tell you a little bit more about that. But Steve, after our last interview, I was left with my head spinning, as I always am, because you're just a fire hose of fantastic information about economics, including those aspects of economics that deviate from the neoclassical school, which all the big universities teach. And I realized that it's so unusual for me to disagree with you, but I left the last interview saying, wow, Steve is on the other side of a major argument, which is I've always felt that the U.S. dollar having the world's reserve currency, although it may not benefit the entire world, certainly benefits the ability of the United States to fund its deficits. And there's another argument, which I think that you tend to favor, which is that it would actually be to the benefit of the United States if it would lose its reserve currency status of the U.S. dollar. So why don't we start by you making that argument? How could losing reserve currency status possibly be to the benefit of the United States?
Well, I'll go back a bit and ask, why did the U.S. get the reserve status in the first place? And that's because it did, I don't know how graphic I can be with your audience, but it waggled its stick around at the Bretton Woods Agreement, because the proposal on the table from Keynes for a post-Second World War monetary system was not to go back to the gold standard, which Keynes called a barbarous relic, quote unquote, but to introduce an international currency called the bancor, which would be used for trade between different nations. If Britain wanted to borrow something off America, it would need to convert pounds into bancor at the IMF, acting as a sort of global central bank, transfer the bancor to America, and they would then be converted from bancor into dollars back in the USA. So the bancor would have been the international currency issued in proportion to the size of each country's GDP. And of course, America would have got the largest share of bancors at that stage. And the proposal was to use a system of semi-fixed exchange rates to reduce the scale of a balance of payments differences between countries. So the objective was to have trade deficits of, I think, no greater than 2% of GDP, and the same for surpluses. And the idea was to use the need to have bancor would be driven by trade and by financial flows. And if you're running a trade deficit, you run out of bancor, so you'd be forced to devalue. On the other side, if you're running a surplus, then there was a discouragement built in. First of all, you'd be taxed past a surplus of about 2% of GDP. And then ultimately, you'd be forced to stimulate your demand for imports. So the idea was to use this international currency to reduce what Keynes saw as the deflating impact of countries running surpluses on global trade. He saw that as being one of the destabilizing factors of the pre-Second World War period. Now, when it came to the actual Bretton Woods, a little bloke called Harry Dexter White represented the USA, and he pretty much said, no, we won the Second World War, therefore we want to take over from the pound as the reserve currency, completely overruling Keynes and all his proposals, removing all the controls that were built into the bank or structure to stop balance of payments imbalances becoming too extreme. And lo and behold, over time, first of all, America starts running large deficits, having run large surpluses, which is what Dexter White, you know, saw going on forever, and it was, of course, wrong. And then you had the floating exchange rate after de Gaulle's attack on Nixon. And then you finally had the level of instability we have now, where countries like China and Japan, Germany, Switzerland, Norway, and a few others are running trade surpluses of the order of 10% of GDP. And America, of course, has used its power as the only country that can't run out of American dollars to wave its financial stick over the planet. And to me, this has all been this level of chaos and confusion we wouldn't have had if Keynes's proposal had gone forward.
Steve, another point that a lot of people make is that from the perspective of exports, it would be better if the United States were not the reserve currency because export businesses would be able to export their product perhaps with a lower dollar and it would be cheaper for foreign buyers. Please outline that argument and any other reasons that you can see that it might be to the benefit of at least some aspects of American business if the U.S. dollar were no longer the reserve currency.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you had the bancor system, which was Keynes's idea, of course, then the bancor's relative ratio to other currencies would depend upon volumes of international trade growth in different economies. And you'd buy bancor, you've got to buy them off the IMF. You couldn't buy them off another country. Since we're using the dollar, every country has a demand for dollars, not just to buy American goods, but to take part in international trade in general. So the demand for American dollars far exceeds the demand necessary for simple exports and imports. And that demand, of course, drives up the relative value in a floating exchange rate system, the relative value of the American dollar. And I haven't done any empirical estimates of this myself, but I have seen claims that the American dollar is anywhere between 30 and 100% overvalued. In other words, it would be anywhere between, say, 20% cheaper and 50% cheaper than it currently is. And of course, that would have meant, first of all, it would mean that American manufacturing now would be much more competitive than it is. Secondly, if you go back to the 1990s, when America began to relocate production from the Midwest to China and turn the Midwest into the Rust Belt and China into the world's industrial powerhouse, it was doing that to exploit enormous differences in wages between Chinese workers and American workers. Now, the differences would still have been there, but they would have been half as large. And I think the level of relocation of production away from America to third world export industrialization zones would have been far lower. So I think this has actually led to the deindustrialization of America.
Way back in the 1960s, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, who at the time was the French finance minister, later he went on to be the president of France, coined the phrase exorbitant privilege. And in his description, the United States, he felt, had this exorbitant privilege, an unfair advantage which the U.S. derived as a result of being the reserve currency issuer. And what he described is, look, the U.S. can effectively go into debt for free because there's so much artificial demand for U.S. dollars from all the other countries around the world that the U.S. can engage in deficit spending and run up just astronomical amounts of national debt, which in other countries that are not the reserve issuer, all of that debt would eventually lead to much higher sovereign bond yields and higher cost of borrowing and all these other problems. The U.S., according to d'Estaing, kind of got a free ride. And the result of that is that it has allowed the U.S. to borrow and spend beyond its means without really paying any penalty for that. And it's no surprise that we have politicians saying deficits don't matter, because although I think deficits do matter in the end, the reality of the situation is you can get away with deficit spending much more easily if you're the reserve currency issuer. And that's exactly what the U.S. has been doing, is getting away with excessive deficit spending. The other thing about this, is, and I think it's really the same argument you just made, but looked at from the opposite perspective, is that for most countries, if you want to be able to import things from other nations because you want their goods and services, you've got to export the same amount of stuff in order to have a balance of trade. only the reserve currency issuer can get away with running a massive current account deficit, meaning we import all kinds of goods and services from around the world. We get their stuff. We don't have to send any stuff back in return. We get to be the consumer of all of that stuff because there's so much demand for dollars. Now, I certainly understand, and this was DeStang's point, is for the rest of the world, it seems like the U.S. has an unfair advantage that's not fair to everybody else. And I certainly understand that argument. But from the perspective of the U.S. and the U.S. government in particular, it seems to me that reserve currency status is what has allowed the United States to get away with all of this excessive deficit spending. We get away with running a massive, massive trade deficit, Steve, which nobody else could get away with. We don't have to balance our trade. We get to import all the good stuff. We export military hardware, which gives us a lot of political control over other countries. But in terms of building widgets and sending to other countries, we don't have to do that. So it seems to me that although it may be unfair to the rest of the world, the U.S. really does have this unfair advantage that DeStang described. And if we were to lose reserve currency status, and by the way, I think that's a very real risk, is we'll get into the petrodollar system in just a minute. But if Saudi Arabia is threatening to ditch the dollar for oil trade, we could lose reserve currency status awfully quickly and suddenly find that we can't get away with financing our government spending the way we're used to. And all of a sudden, deficits matter and they matter a whole lot. And I think the U.S. government would be in big, big trouble and be facing a dramatic increase in the cost of borrowing. Am I missing something to think that loss of reserve currency status poses those risks to the U.S. government?
I agree with about 70% of what you've said, but I need to attenuate quite a bit of it. And first of all, you're focusing upon the risks of the government sector. And we want to backtrack and say, what actually is a reasonable level of a government deficit? What are the deficits that matter? And if you look at the world in terms of a functional view of how money is distributed, you have your private sector, which can borrow from the private non-financial sector, which can borrow from the banking sector. You have your government and you have your international system. So you have a private sector deficit, a government deficit, and a trade deficit. Those are your three possibilities. And the sum of all of them, when you've got to invert the sign of the trade deficit, but the sum of all is what is a deficit for one is a surplus for the other. So if you look at the world in government versus non-government, if the government is running a surplus, then the rest of the world is running a deficit. If you look at in terms of domestic versus foreign, if you're running a deficit, there's a matching surplus elsewhere in the world, so on and so forth. Now, when I look at that in terms of what's the sustainable situation over time, if you have a growing economy and a growing money supply, and you have, say, the private sector wanting to save money, the private sector wants to have its expenditure being less than its income, it is going to have to be running somehow, getting more money in than it's sending out. The only way that can happen if the reverse flow is happening for another part of the economy. So if you're going to have the government's going to be running a surplus, the private sector runs a deficit. Is that sustainable? Where does the private sector cover its deficit from? It'll cover it from the private banks, which means that private deficit becomes an accumulated level of private debt, which can cause crises like we saw in 2008. It's an unsustainable thing. If the government's running a deficit and therefore the private sector's running a surplus, how does it finance it? Ultimately, any country issuing its own currency, and that of course includes America, has the capacity to produce that currency and finance its own debt using its own capacity to create its own money. So on that front, it's more sustainable for the government to run a deficit than it is for the private sector. However, you then have the issue of what happens to your international sector. Now, what I've said so far is consistent with what's called modern monetary theory, if you've heard of MMT being discussed in recent debates. Where I differ from MMT is they underrate the importance of the foreign sector. They think that it's actually they will tell you that exports are a cost and imports are a benefit. I just completely reject that perspective. But what it leads them to saying effectively, though they don't actually say it explicitly, is, well, you should run a trade surplus because you're sending over pieces of paper, you're getting back goods and services. Now, that to me, I think, comes out of what you've been speaking about, which is America's capacity to do that because they have the reserve currency status. Any other country that tried that indefinitely, would start to see its currency devalue. We've seen this happening with Turkey recently. You can't run a persistent trade deficit as a country that's not issuing the reserve currency. America can get away with that. And I think that's led to a lot of the excesses you're talking about. But then mainly, the main impact of, I think, has been, well, firstly, the political power of the government sector, obviously, but then also the financial power of the financial sector of America to purchase assets anywhere else in the world and to become the global financial system, to become fundamentally the American financial system extended, which I think has also been quite damaging to the global economy, but quite strong privilege to the American financial sector.
Let's take this theoretical and pull it into the practical, because just last week, Saudi Arabia has threatened, look, this NOPEC bill, which is before Congress, which would allow the United States to effectively sue Saudi Arabia using antitrust laws in the United States and apply them to OPEC and say you can't have a cartel. The threat is basically, if you don't drop this thing, we're going to drop the dollar as our pricing mechanism. Now, of course, the petrodollar system, which was really conceived just after the Nixon shock when we broke away from the original Bretton Woods agreement that the U.S. dollar would be backed and convertible into gold. The idea was by pressuring Saudi Arabia to price its exports of oil in dollars, regardless of who they were selling it to, they essentially forced the international trade settlement currency to be dollars, even though the Bretton Woods agreement was no longer being honored by the United States. And the result of that, the whole idea of what the U.S. was trying to accomplish with the petrodollar agreement, was to make sure that there continued to be this artificial demand for the U.S. dollar and that it would continue to effectively be the world's global reserve currency. If Saudi Arabia were to actually carry out this threat and ditch the dollar and start pricing all of their oil for export to other nations in something other than dollars, in euros or yuan or gold or who knows what, that would mean that the very large artificial demand for U.S. dollars offshore would start to dry up. And it seems to me, although I do very much appreciate your argument that, hey, if the U.S. had not been given this license to recklessly borrow and spend for the last 60 years, we might be in better shape than we are today. But the reality, Steve, is we have got $21 trillion now. If all of a sudden we lose this reserve currency status, there's no longer an artificial demand for U.S. dollars, anything close to what it is now, because the petrodollar system, let's say, were to suddenly collapse, doesn't that create a fiscal crisis for the United States where suddenly we can't fund our deficit spending and we look at potentially seeing U.S. Treasury yields just go through the roof?
I don't think it's the one thing, the yields go through the roof, because the yields really are controlled by the Federal Reserve's capacity to set that band for its own debt between its two target ranges, because it's basically the monopoly supplier and monopoly buyer, fundamentally from the financial to the private sector, of American dollars. So it can control the interest rates. If you look at, again, I mean, just to give you, just to put a bit of cold water on the whole idea that a currency collapse or a crisis is going to lead to you having to have monumental interest rates because of all the government debt you've got, the biggest government debt in the world that is owned by Japan, it's about 2.5 times G. What's the interest rate over there? Close to zero, has been for 15 years. So if you get a straight link, what you will see is a currency valuation link. So if you do have the American dollar being not replaced completely, but having a competitive system brought about not by the Saudis, but also I know Turkey is considering a similar thing with his other Islamic neighbors, and so is Russia and China, and to some extent Europe, are talking about something because they want to get away from all the outright abuses of that power that have become extreme in the hand of Trump. So you have, you know, those three potential factors giving you an alternative means for international exchange, not using the American dollar. If that happens, then yes, your dollar value is going to fall quite dramatically. And that would impinge upon the capacity to import from the rest of the world as easily as you've done. And yet at the same time, you can't replace that by domestic production because your manufacturing sector has been run down so significantly in the last 25 years that you don't have the capacity to expand that production anymore. So I can see it as giving America quite a severe jolt, but it won't be something which causes interest rates to go sky high. They will still be held in a band by the Federal Reserve. You might see rises in corporate rates and so on, but not large rates rises in the rates on American government debt.
Now, most of the products that you see at Walmart in the United States are imported from China. So it seems to me that if this were to occur and there was a marked devaluation of the U.S. dollar versus other currencies, that would result in a massive inflation shock in the real economy in the U.S. because we don't have the manufacturing capacity to make widgets in the United States. That's all gone offshore to the detriment, perhaps, of the American worker. But, you know, we don't have that capacity. So if all of a sudden we have to pay much higher prices in dollars in order to generate the same price in yuan or yen or whatever for the imported goods, doesn't that result in a really big inflation shock inside the U.S.?
It can. I mean, inflation shocks, you have to look them in proper empirical context. And most economists simply assume any currency devaluation would lead to an equivalent inflation spike in the country devaluing. What actually happens quite frequently is firms will try to, first of all, you have long-term contracts determining prices, often set out 2 to 5 years in advance, particularly for industrial goods. But mainly, we have importers putting a markup on their imports for their profit level. They're willing to cut that markup to hang on to market share to some extent. So you don't see 100% pass-through of that sort of thing. You might see 30% pass-through. So if you had a 10, 15, 20% devaluation in the economy, in the American dollar, then you could see, yes, a 5 or so, so maybe maximum, I wouldn't see it going beyond 10% spike in the inflation rate. But yes, you could see that spike occurring. And it would also, you know, obviously cramp the style of any Americans wanting to go over overseas holidays. So there's it would definitely be a decrease in American living standards. And it would bring home to people, too, the extent to which you have been deindustrialized and relied upon this exorbitant privilege to get over it. If the exorbitant privilege goes, then you wear the fuller consequences of being deindustrialized in the last 25 years.
Steve, let's come to the current risks that the U.S. dollar faces in terms of maintaining its reserve currency status and talk about how real they are. Is this talk from Saudi Arabia just saber-rattling, or are they really serious about ditching the dollar? Likewise, we had another comment last week from, I believe it was a former undersecretary of the U.N., calling for a global currency to replace the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. Are these things really at risk of actually happening, or is this just talk?
I think it's a risk of happening. I don't think the Saudis are going to go through with it, though, because they're incredibly intimately tied up with American military power, and it'd just be too dangerous for them to do that. But I know China and Russia and to some extent Europe are talking about it because they're sick of the extent to which this has been used as a bullying tool by America. Particularly, just one recent example, the decision not to let the Iran use the SWIFT system for international payments. That could never have happened if the American dollar wasn't the reserve currency. And that sort of, you know, you get America imposing its political will on the rest of the world using the fact that it's the reserve currency. And of course, that's become intolerable under Trump. So I think the odds are fair, you know, let's say 1 in 3 of a serious breakdown in that in the next 10 years. But it could also be prevented. I mean, it's one of these things that it doesn't have the weight of you know, financial numbers behind it, like I could see with the credit crunch back in 2008 to say a crisis is inevitable. But certainly there'll be strains on this system, and the American dominance can't be guaranteed. And the more America now tries to assert that dominance, the more likely it is to encourage one of those alternatives to be developed.
Well, we certainly have this coming from a number of fronts. Russia and China have been talking about this de-dollarization campaign for years. Recently, they've kind of got the European Union partially on board, looking for an alternative to SWIFT to prevent the United States from being able to impose sanctions on countries and on businesses, which, at least in the eyes of the rest of the world, the U.S. has no jurisdiction over. As we think about how this might go, let's assume that there is significant pressure on the reserve currency status and that of course, this is not a binary thing. It's not a switch that gets turned off one day. Let's assume that the dollar is used less and less in coming years, both as a trade settlement currency and as a central bank reserve asset. Talk us through what the consequences of that would be, both for the United States, both government sector and private sector, as well as for the rest of the world.
Well, obviously, it's going to mean a reduction of demand for American dollars on foreign exchange markets, which must mean a fall in the price over time. That'll be complicated by the usual spot and hedge markets and so on. But yes, seeing a fall in the value of the dollar, its financial sector could no longer use the fact that it was American to have the power it has over financial institutions elsewhere in the world, so that the scale of the financial sector would be pulled back. Your manufacturing sector would be more competitive, but as you know, you don't have the industrial pattern you used to have. You've still got some outstanding corporations and outstanding technological capability, but you don't have that machine tool background. The skilled workers that used to exist there aren't there anymore. So there'd be a serious shock to America with more expensive goods to be imported from overseas and a slow shift towards having a local manufacturing capability, making up for the damage of the last 25 years. I can see a lot of social conflict out of that as well, but a positive for the American working class, who really have been done over in the last quarter century. And that's partly a reason why Trump has come about. And ironically, Trump is part of the reason why this might come to an end, given how much he's used his bombast and the American reserve currency status as a thug's tool in foreign relations rather than an intelligent person's tool.
Steve, I want to return to the subject of modern monetary theory, which you brought up a few minutes ago. This has become a very hot topic, and I think it's going to be incredibly important in the political discussion going forward. So as I understand it, the basic essence of what MMT is about is that for countries like the United States that have the luxury of being able to borrow in their own currency, the argument is made that, look, inflation is always a risk, but if there's no inflation, which right now we don't seem to have a really big inflation risk, there's really nothing wrong with the government monetizing a lot of social spending. So we could have universal basic income and a whole bunch of additional social benefits, and we don't have to raise taxes. We can just print the money, essentially, and it's not going to hurt anything. Deficits don't matter, it seems to me, is the way I interpret this message. And what surprised me is I know the whole thrust of your message for as long as I've known you has been, look, debt is the problem. Excessive debt is the problem. So I expected to hear you be an outspoken critic of MMT and say, no, more debt, it does matter. It's no good. MMT is bad. But I think you actually are somewhat of a supporter. So help me understand this. What am I missing?
Okay, you're missing a division between the different types of debt. Let's stick with a vision of a domestic economy right now, just for a starting point, and bring out international later. But if you have a financial system, let's say it's got divided into three sectors, let's say a government sector, a household sector, and firm sector. And let's assume they've each got 100 million, billion, trillion, whatever dollars in their bank account, and they turn it over twice a year. So I'm just working in hundreds. I want to give an arithmetic example of what MMT is about before we go into discussing its finer points. So if you have $100 sitting in each of those three sectors' accounts, and each of them spending $100 per year on the other, so the government spending $100 on the household sector and $100 on the firms, and the firms are spending $100 on the households, $100 on the government, however the spending's caused, your total expenditure is $600 per year. Your total income is $600 per year. They're necessarily identical to each other. If you then have one of them saying, I want to save money, so I'm going to spend, rather than spending $100 per year on the other two sectors, I'm going to spend $95 per year on the other two sectors. Well, that then happens that particular year. So this sector spends $190, but it gets $200 back from the other two sectors. It makes a saving of $10. Great. Only what happened to the other two sectors? Well, they previously had income of $200 and expenditure of $200. They've now got income of $195 now, still expenditure of $200. So they each have a minus $5 of savings. So the sector that saved $10 is at the expense of the other two that have now got minus $5 each. All you've done is redistribute who's got the money. You haven't created additional money because I've started with the idea there's a fixed amount of money in the system. So the point I want to make out of that is that if you are running a surplus in that situation, whatever your one particular sector, the other two are necessarily running at precisely the same deficit. the aggregate level of savings, in other words, is zero. So what adjusts when you do that sort of thing? What actually changes is income. Previously had an income of $600 per year. Now you've got an income of $590 per year. So the attempt to save at the level of one sector causes a fall in income at the aggregate level. And this is what Keynes called the fallacy of composition. We think it's a good idea to save for ourselves. We therefore think saving is a good idea at the national level. When everybody saves at the national level, because aggregate savings is zero, you get no savings. You get a fall in GDP precisely equal to the amount you're trying to save. Now, that's the intellectual framework I'm starting from, and it's rock solid because it's simply looking at the accounting there. What that means is if you want to have a growing GDP over time, 600, 610, 620, 630, 640, either the money has to turn over more rapidly, and I'll come back to that, or the option I'll consider first, somebody has to create that money. Now, you can create that money by yourself going into debt. If you borrow money from the private banking sector, you get additional money. It also comes with additional debt. In the net terms, you have a zero gain. If the government borrows money, it borrows the money from a central bank. Who owns this? This is a very, I'm cutting down the steps in between, of course, because, of course, the central bank is, the treasurer is required to sell bonds to the private sector. The central bank can buy those off the private sector, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just going to jump over that detail for now. But if the government can actually continue running a deficit with its own central bank because it owns its own central bank. It can pay the interest bill using a call on the central bank, et cetera, et cetera. So what it means is the question comes down to, does the private sector have a capacity to run a permanent deficit, letting the government run a permanent surplus? Answer is no. Does the government have a capacity to run a permanent deficit, allowing the private sector to run a permanent surplus? The answer is yes. And this is what's turned up in the empirical data. If you look at the figure for the American government surplus over the last 120 years, and you'll find this data at the White House, the surplus the government has run on average for the last 120 years is minus 2.4% of GDP. In other words, the standard deficit has been 2.4% of GDP. If you take out the wars, it's still 2.2% of GDP. So the standard situation is the government runs a deficit and therefore the private sector runs a surplus. Now, that is the sound foundational basis of MMT. It then says, well, you know, which sector do you want to have maintaining a deficit? One of them has to, one or the other. The sum is zero. And the answer is the safest choice is the government to do it. But then the dangers become, what if the government runs too big a deficit? Then you face the danger of either runaway inflation or runaway trade deficit.
So if the claim is that during periods where we don't have major inflation risk, it's okay to have deficit spending, why wouldn't the very first thing we do with this miracle power of MMT be to eliminate taxes during periods where there's no major inflation risk? We know for certain that reducing taxes stimulates the economy. Why wouldn't we start, before we worry about giving things away in, you know, universal basic income or something, by not taking money away from the people who earned it?
I'm actually a critic of income tax, so I better preface that with this remark, because when you get that perspective that the government can afford to run a permanent deficit, it inverts your understanding about the role of taxes. At the moment, we think of taxes as being needed to fund government spending. When you look at it from the point of view and say, well, the government creates its own money, that creates its capacity to spend, you then look at how big is government spending. Before the Great Depression and Second World War, government was about 5% of the GDP. This is even during the Civil War period. Now it's 30%. So if the government finances activities by simply printing money and not taxing it, it'd be increasing the money supply by something of the order of 15 to 30% per annum. I think you get a pretty massive runaway inflation level with that. So the taxation's role is to take that money out. And we've been doing income tax, I think, ever since about the Great Depression. We relied upon customs duties and stuff like that beforehand. I think it's actually a very ineffective way of taking money out of circulation. I would rather have a transactions tax system and then fine-tune it to the extent to which you not seeing as a way of financing government spending, but trying to stop too much money being pumped into the economy any one time and stop too much of that accumulating in one social class's hand. At the moment, without doubt, because of the capacity of the wealthy to evade their tax liabilities, whereas the middle class don't have that and the poor don't have either income or the ability to evade, you've got an enormous increase in inequality coming out of the income tax system. So I'd rather change over to transactions tax-based system and then set it up so you know, you get your gap between government spending and government taxation, not leading to an excessive creation of money.
So coming back to the subject of modern monetary theory and the risks or opportunities that it potentially introduces, it sounds like you're generally fairly open to the idea, but still have some criticisms. So help our listeners understand, for the people who are trying to get their head around MMT, is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? Should we take it seriously? Is it something that we should be looking at as a philosophy for how we run governments? What are the ups and downs that they need to understand?
Okay, well, look, I'll put out two little points. One little point where I disagree with MMT, so that's off the table straight away, and that is that I disagree with their perspective on international trade. They start from a very different basis for international trade, talking about exports being a cost, imports being a benefit, arguing in favor of the use of actually, have been not explicitly saying it as honestly as I'd like them to say it, but ending up saying running a trade deficit's a good idea. I disagree with that. But on the domestic monetary analysis, I think they're spot on. And what it means is you turn upside down your understanding of the government role. The government doesn't need to tax in order to spend. It spends and then taxes to take excess money out of circulation. That means in that sense that it's not constrained by a hard budget constraint, which most of us are constrained by. If as individuals, non-government individuals and companies, if you're permanently running expenditure greater than income, you're going to be forced to cut back because you're going to run out of dollars. That can't happen to the American government. It can't run out of dollars. So that means it's liberated from those constraints. And then the question is, well, what are the main constraints upon it? It ends up being the practical constraints of that particular economy, your physical capabilities, the resources you have, the infrastructure you have, the people you have. If they are unemployed, or if you have a lower level of innovation than you would like, et cetera, you can use the government's financial capacity to create that. We saw that classically for America during the Apollo period, when just the decision to compete with the Russians and getting the first human being onto the moon meant an enormous amount of money being spent in fundamental research into rocket science, which we have ultimately benefited from, far more so we've benefited from a war. There'd be no negative side effects. So the government can create that spending. It can finance universal basic income, as you said. It can finance university education. You don't need to charge student fees. I would rather actually have the government create money by giving money to students to spend than giving it to bureaucrats to spend. So it gives you a creative freedom for an economy whose resources are not fully employed. And it means you stimulate Main Street, if you like, directly rather than stimulating Wall Street, which is what we've done by the current economic philosophy, which comes out of neoclassical economics rather than MMT.
But Steve, it still seems to me when I look at the way politicians are latching on to MMT, they want to use it as a license to just spend on everything they can think of in order to give constituents every possible free giveaway in order to buy votes. It seems to me that that has to ultimately lead to a massive increase in indebtedness. And I know that you've said before that excessive debt has been the whole problem. So, how do I reconcile these ideas?
Well, back again to the nature of debt. I mean, pork barreling is as American as apple pie. I don't need to tell you that. Who's the member for Boeing these days? Obviously, going to have a lot of work on his or her hands right now with the 737 MAX story. But you've had corporations effectively buying American politicians for decades. So you've got the pork barreling thing. The thing is, when you believe there's a restraint on government spending caused by needing to tax before you can spend, then you have a limit on that pork barreling. And a lot of people who know that the practical finance is the other way around. This includes, for example, Paul Samuelson, since deceased, but he was aware of this. He said, we tell a porky fundamentally about the government's funding because that way we stop the politicians excessively pork barreling. So it was seen as a way, even those who knew that the description of this before you can spend was wrong, they thought that was a way of stopping the politicians getting their fingers too deeply into the trough. Now, when you look at the issue, yes, you're going to owe government debt doing that. The question comes back to what type of debt are we talking about? Where does the government have to borrow the money from? If the government had to borrow the money from private financial corporations and pay them interest on it, et cetera, in a currency it didn't produce itself, it'd be in serious problems. But it's borrowers, it fundamentally sells bonds to the financial sector, but the central bank can buy all those bonds back off the financial sector anyway. And then when the bonds are paid, the interest is paid by effectively the Treasury telling the central bank to credit the accounts of people who got those bonds. So the funding issues for a government are much, much simpler than the funding issues for a private entity. So when I worry about the level of debt, I'm fundamentally concerned about the level of private debt. That's what's ignored. So just to give you listeners a bit of a picture on that, I think the current level of government debt's about 110% of GDP in America, maybe a bit less. Current level of private debt sector debt, private non-financial sector, just the debt of the non-financial corporations and households to the financial sector, is 1.5 times GDP. And it was 1.7 times, 170% back when the financial crisis peaked. So to me, it's the private debt that matters. The government debt is effectively like government equity in your economy, because again, the government can't go bankrupt in its own currency. It can run out of another currency if it needs it. That's Argentina's problem, Venezuela's as well, quite probably. But America can't run out of American dollars. So the worries about not being able to pay your debt as a government, not being able to have the currency, not having enough of the currency to spend to cover your debts, it doesn't apply for a national government, but it does apply for individuals and for corporations.
Steve, before we close, I want to move on to another topic, which I know is very much near and dear to your heart, and that is the role of economics in the university system and how well the university system is doing in terms of being true to reality with its teachings. You are a guy who has an amazing track record. You, with astonishing accuracy, predicted the 2008 crisis before it happened. You laid out what was going to happen, why it was going to happen, and how it was going to happen. You would think a guy with that kind of track record would be, you know, teaching at the very best Ivy League universities. You seem to want nothing to do with Ivy League universities because you don't believe what they're teaching. For when I first met you, you were associated with not an Ivy League university, but a very well-known university in London. And I know that since our last interview, you've left that university, and I believe that was out of some frustration with the whole system. And you've now gone on to basically being professor at large, teaching economics to those who are interested in learning what you have to say, and you're funded through Patreon. How is a guy with your track record, either unwanted by the university system or what has happened to the university system that you don't want to be part of it, that has led you to basically being a freelance professor? This is a very unusual situation.
Well, I'm afraid I've got so used to it, I'd take it as the norm, but you're right, it is crazy. In any other discipline, if you had somebody who, you know, predicted a serious earthquake before it happened, or somebody who warned of serious storms, or somebody who stopped a plane from crashing, warned it was going to crash, yeah, you'd be in demand at the leading universities. But in economics, there's an ideology that dominates, which we call it neoclassical economics. It began in the 1870s. It had legitimate reasons for its development back at that stage, but it's basically proved itself completely wrong, internally inconsistent. But it's continued on, because once people believe something, it's very hard to get them to stop believing it. And therefore, neoclassical economics sails on, despite the fact that neoclassical economists predicted 2008 was going to be a fantastic year. Bet the house a year. They were all saying how it was going to be a booming economy, and they had no idea this crisis was coming. And yet the consequences for the economists who believed that and got it wrong has been they've continued having the same old jobs at the same old universities, because the economy continues to operate, even if economists are wrong about how it functions. But if engineers were wrong about how planes flew, they'd all crash. So the consequences for an economist of being wrong are nothing like the consequences for an engineer. And therefore, you can continue reproducing a false ideology indefinitely. And that's what's happened in the universities. And because they dominate the journals and dominate the selection systems, dominate the government funding bodies as well, they are the ones who decide who gets to teach at which universities. So as a result of that, people like myself, who are non-mainstream and criticize them, can't get jobs at the top universities. We can only get them at lowly ranked ones like Kingston or University of Western Sydney, which I used to be at beforehand. They're the ones which put on the non-orthodox programs. But the people like Gregory Mankiw and so on dominate programs like Harvard.
Well, Steve, at least this dark cloud has a silver lining to it, because we have a lot of listeners who might really enjoy learning a lot more about economics because they're so interested in it as investors. Unfortunately, as much as many of them might like to go back and get a degree in it, they don't have time to go back to university. They've got lives to lead and careers to work in. You have moved on from the university system. You're now offering a formal education. You're a very experienced professor who's worked in the university system, and you're effectively become professor at large, offering an economic education to anyone who wants it, and you're not focused on neoclassical economics. So please tell our audience what you do focus on and where they can learn more about it, and how much does it cost?
Well, it basically costs us a minimum of $1 a month and as much as you want to give above that to support me on Patreon, where I'm now under, if you want the actual URL, it's www.patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen. And I now have about 1,100 supporters there who are giving me something close to about $8,000 a month in return for getting access to my regular blogs on that particular site, to my book, Debunking Economics, and Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis, and anything else I'm producing as well. So it's not a formal education system as yet, but it is an exposure to my non-orthodox ways of looking at the economy, which include having a monetary approach. And on that basis, I've built a software package I called Minsky for doing monetary non-equilibrium modeling. And all the insights of that turn up on my Patreon page. And I've also started doing work recently on the role of energy in production, which has been completely neglected by all schools of economics, not just the neoclassicals. I'm now doing that work with Tim Garrett, who's a leading atmospheric physicist. So it's an exposure to a pretty much an engineering-based monetary non-equilibrium vision of economics through my Patreon page. And over time, I hope I'll finally get to that that formal education component as well. But in the meantime, I think the best place to learn economics is outside the university sector.
It's a sad statement about the university system, but definitely an opportunity for our listeners, because I certainly think that you have the clearest and most concise explanations of how things really work in the real world. So, folks, I encourage you to check out. Again, it's patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen, P-R-O-F, Steve, K-E-E-N. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Steve Keen. You know, it's always great. I mean, I think that's our fourth time having him on the show, and each interview I pick up something new from him. It was great. What did you take away from it?
Well, I really enjoyed this interview because, frankly, I agree with the left political parties that I'm not really in agreement on all subjects. But one thing that I do agree with is that the system that we have is corrupt and needs to be changed. I just think the people that are trying to throw capitalism away are missing the point, and it's cronyism we need to throw away. Steve is about as left-leaning as they come, and he's also a really smart guy who knows his stuff. So it's a treat for me to hear someone whose political views are a little different from mine, but hear his ideas about how we should be fixing some of the social injustices that exist in the world. Because I think his views are a lot more credible, frankly, than a lot of others that I hear from other people of that same far left-leaning political persuasion. In any event, Patrick, I am so jealous of you, because I spent this week 6.5 hours of listening to back episodes of Macro Voices as I was stuck driving in a snowstorm, while you were both drinking beers with Russell Napier, a guy I would love to meet face to face and get to know, and also, of course, attending the Practical History of Financial Markets. So I can't wait to hear about this class. What did you learn? What happened there? And tell us all about it.
Well, first of all, it wasn't just myself that got to drink beers with Russell Napier, but a number of our Macro Voice listeners who registered for the course, and I had an opportunity to meet, so I wanted to do a shout out to them as well. We had a great conversation with them, and I certainly want to share some of the things I took away. There's really three things I wanted to kind of, that I picked up that I thought I wanted to share with our listeners. The first one was his perspectives on the highly elevated levels of the CAPE ratio, and particularly what would drive a reversion in these highly elevated levels. And of course, intuitively, we would say that deflation is the one driver that would cause a reversion in this. But the one interesting thing I picked up on the program was, in fact, actually highly elevated levels of inflation would also do the same. And particularly the sweet spot number through history has been inflation levels above 4% also drive reversion in that CAPE ratio. And so it's really about the economy running in this sweet spot where you don't have deflation, but you don't have inflation running too hot either. And so I thought that was really interesting that the risk is on both ends of the spectrum. The second thing that I thought was really interesting was counterintuitively to what it looks to me, at least on the surface, in terms of inflation. One of the arguments I picked up in the course was that central banks are simply not creating enough money. And I'm like, what do you mean they're not creating enough money? We went through QEs and the central banks are printing. But, you know, when you look at the charts and everything, you're seeing the rate of debt growth relative to the rate of growth of money. You continue to see divergence and they go through and explain so many of the reasons why that is. But what really was the one thing that I wanted to share was I had to ask him. I mean, he was on the show just a couple months ago and he blew us both away with his idea that China was moving towards potentially being forced to float their currency. And I had to ask him about this and whether or not, obviously, as Fed policy is shifting and trade negotiations are moving forward, whether his views have changed at all on this. And really, they have not. His views is that the trade negotiations are likely not to be a factor in solving the problem, which is that China is moving toward a negative current account as a percentage of GDP, and that they're just at an impasse that this is the way that it will likely come to fruition. And I can't help but to keep thinking that if this ever came to pass, this would arguably be one of the biggest macro events of our time, with powerful implications on the world.
Wow. Well, Patrick, I could ask you about 27,000 questions about exactly what you learned and how it went. And maybe I will off the air. But meanwhile, our listeners are waiting to get into another of your famous chart books. So listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. And Patrick, why don't we go ahead and dive into this deck? What are we looking at here?
Well, charts two and three. Well, first, chart two is the rally template we drew on for using. I usually use past market scenarios to kind of extrapolate forward a roadmap of what it would look like if this was a bear market rally versus if this was something more like 2016, where there would be, after a big correction, a continuation to higher highs. And so that's 2 month old chart. So I move on to chart three. And I just updated the candles to show where we are today versus when we started drawing that. And certainly, the chart looks far more like the bullish narrative than the bearish one, which obviously, with me having a bearish bias, is not what I like to see on the charts. But it's certainly demonstrating a strength heading right back to its previous highs. So I wanted to sort of ask the question, well, what if? Like, I know the Kevin Muirs of the world are starting to kind of play this idea that we could have a 1998 market melt-up in late business cycle and that there's still a chance that could rally. I mean, we can't rule that out, right, Eric? I mean, you've talked about it numerous times in the market wrap at the start of the show. But what I wanted to move on in chart four was to actually look at the Russell 2000 and ask an important question. Why is the Russell and the small caps not getting the memo that there's this big bull surge happening, because here we can't get the Russell above its February highs. It continues to just consolidate sideways, not move. And then you go to even specific sectors like the financials, which continue to be massive laggards. And to me, I'm like, what is the reason that this is happening? If we were about to rip into a new bull phase higher, shouldn't these components be behaving that way, very similar to the S&P?
Well, and you know, I think that's a really important point, because oftentimes when you're going to see, you know, breakouts to new all-time highs and so forth, it's actually the small caps that tend to lead the way. They're clearly lagging here, and I think you've got to look at both other indices, you got to look at currency pairs. And the thing that I find hardest to reconcile is just how strong this equity rally is, when really the bond market is still flashing recession warnings, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, we came off of that 2.37 or whatever the low print was on the 10-year yield and got back above 250. But Patrick, in the week or two prior to that, the market had effectively crashed as soon as it took out 260 to the downside. You know, we were down to 240 before we knew it. It seems to me like all the ingredients are there for, you know, the market broke down sharply, surprised a lot of people. Then it retraced about 50%, good fib level. Looks to me like it's starting to roll back over and move back down. That would be a confirmation signal. And usually when stocks and bonds don't agree, the bond market is more likely to be right. But there's lots and lots of people who have observed that, and the stocks continue to march higher. And, you know, certainly Charlie McElligott has explained a few reasons that there should be some small tailwinds for the S&P. We're back into corporate buybacks, and so that's helping S&P. Maybe that's part of the reason that we're seeing the S&P move up and not the Russell, is those Russell companies are small caps. Those companies are generally less able to access Wall Street financing. So as far as floating a bond to buy their own shares with, maybe they don't have the ability to do that some of the S&P issues have. That would explain part of it, but I think we need to look a little deeper.
You know, actually, I think we should circle back to this buyback issue, because maybe we'll do it in next week's postgame. But I really want to touch on this, because there was a couple great pieces from Goldman Sachs that were talking about the implications if the rules on buybacks were changed. So let's touch on that next week. But in the chart book, I want to move on to page 5, because I wanted to look at the biggest component in the dollar index, and that's the euro. And so as the euro trades, ultimately, it's the component that will drive the direction of the dollar index, with I think it's still around a 57-58% weighting in it. And what I added an overlay here was the volume by price indicator, which is showing the levels where the vast majority of volume on the euro traded. And what's amazing to me is that there's a very clear band between 113 to 115 where we spent pretty much 6 months consolidating in, which contained the vast majority of the volume. And what we've seen is that even though twice, once in November and once in March, the euro poked itself below the 113 level, but almost immediately the buyers came back, bought the dip, and threw it right back into that trade range where all the high volume is, in the 113 to 115 range. But what was amazing was the breakdown that occurred after the FOMC shot that euro back down to 112. And to the naked eye, when someone sees just the chart, it looks like a double bottom retest of the March low. But to me, this is a key breakdown level, because we are seeing now two consecutive weeks which the euro is consolidating below that trade range. Like, it's at lower lows and is not demonstrating any accumulation whatsoever that is showing that this is going to recover. I mean, this to me is like winding up for a breakdown. It's going to be fascinating to see whether this move in the dollar index and subsequently the breakdown in the euro manifests itself here in the coming month, because it really is just at the edge of this cliff.
Well, I couldn't agree more, Patrick. And, you know, it really speaks to that comment that we got from one of our listeners that I mentioned in the market wrap, which is when we talk about the dollar index, really the underlying dollar euro pair that you're showing here on slide 5 really is the governing factor. And if I look at this chart, it looks even more bearish to me than the dollar index chart looks bullish. And of course, these are inversely correlated. Now, I do notice that if you really wanted to be technical and say, okay, it's the series of lower highs and lower lows that really sells your technical message. This last April low appears to be maybe the potential of a double bottom from the March low. And, you know, maybe we're going to see a bounce here for a while. But I think if we break below that double low from March and April, which is right around 112 or so, just below it, if we break and close below that, it really, really increases my conviction about a strong dollar view, weak euro view.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. And it hasn't happened yet, but it really feels like it's at the starting block and we just need a starter gun to go off. And maybe we have one of the biggest macro trend moves get underway here. But the last thing I want to touch on, it's a combination of both page 6 and 7, is I put up the euro dollar futures and particularly the spread between December 2019 to December 2020. Just looking at next year, essentially. And by subtracting the two, you can get an idea of what the euro dollar futures markets are pricing in for the number of rate cuts that they anticipate that the Fed will do in the markets next year. And obviously, after the FOMC, we had an extraordinary breakdown where we went from something like 18, 19 negative basis points, or basically a cut, down to almost 38 basis points on the downside. They almost priced in a full additional rate cut next year on that. Now, we've recovered a bit, but we're still trading at about minus 28 basis points on the spread. And what I thought was fascinating in that is that the bond market is telling a different tale than the equity markets. And I picked up on that JP Morgan report, and that's what we have shared here on page 7. JP Morgan's Nicholas Panagritzoglou, I hope I pronounced that right, observed that the relative signs of complacency in the U.S. equity markets are relative to the implied by the bond markets, are suggesting that traders should be hedging their equity overweights. And one of the points that he tries to show is that both the high yield junk bond market and the stock market are pricing in a probability of a recession next year at just under 10%. 6% and 8% relatively. But yet the bond market is pricing in almost virtually a certainty of a recession next year, pricing in at the current levels over a 70% chance of a recession. And I'm fascinated by this. This is like a tug of war. The bond market is saying that the economy is going to shit in a handbasket, and the equity markets are trying to say, no, that's not what we see. And, you know, I go back to Nigel Ferguson's books on money, and one of the things he always points out is that the bond traders are the smartest guys in the room, right? And I'm wondering, when I see this, I have a hard time kind of abandoning my bear narrative on the stock market. Until the bond market starts to tell a different story, this to me is a big tell.
Well, and you just went through the history class with Russell Napier as well. I mean, everything that I know about the history of markets is that when bonds and stocks don't agree, the bond market is right more often than not. And that would suggest that this rally needs to end at some point. And, you know, I guess the other opportunity that we see here with this much divergence is a pairs trade. You know, if it's not going to be stocks and stocks are going to win, then certainly the bond yield has to go back up. And I think that stocks are going to lose. I think the bond yield is right. I think it's signaling a coming recession. And the one thing that scares me, and the reason that I've stopped trying to pick tops in this stock market to short, is I really think that probably what's going on is there's this overcomplacency, this excessive certainty that no matter what, you know, the Fed's got our back. And I think what everybody's missing is, to some extent, that's true. The Fed is going to want to bail markets out next time there's a really rough patch. What I don't think the market is discounting is the likelihood that there's a populist uprising and that working class Americans say no more bailouts for Wall Street. If we're going to go to QE, it's got to be helicopter money. It's got to be universal basic income. Let's stop bailing out Wall Street and instead bail out Main Street. And I think if you had a shock where, you know, first everybody's expecting the Fed to do their thing, the Fed does their thing, and then the Fed due to political pressure, is forced to reverse course. That's the making not of a bear market, but of an outright crash. But on that cheery note, Patrick, I want to come to another point. You know, we get lots and lots of emails and tweets saying, we love Patrick's postgame chart books. We wish you guys did them every show. Look, you can get them every day with a free 14-day complimentary trial of Big Picture Trading. What Patrick does for a living is daily webinars with all of this kind of fantastic charting content. And it's trading advice, and it's teaching you about technical analysis, fundamental analysis, and so forth. And Macro Voices listeners have the opportunity to get a free 14-day pass. No credit card required. All you have to do is either email contact at Big Picture Trading or just visit www.bigpicturetrading.com. This is also your last chance, folks, in order to get free access to the webinar that Patrick did about the calendared straddle technique that he uses to catch the tops in markets, which he and his members have been extremely successful with and has allowed him to catch the last two significant market tops. We need to leave it there in the interest of time, so please help us to promote Macro Voices by telling your friends and colleagues about it, forward your research roundup emails, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. Benefit to you is you'll receive our free Research Roundup email each week. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview as well as the link to the charts that we discussed in the postgame. There's also the link to the Patreon. So those of you that want to check out Steve Keen on Patreon, it's included in there. There's also a Jeffrey Snyder article titled Inflation is Still Not About Consumer Prices, and a link to the Bank of International Settlements report on the financial cycle and recession risks. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, and myself, @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.